Harbour, Ve Hoş Geldiniz. Yes, hello and welcome to Talking Round North Cyprus. I'm Sarah Palmer, and it's so good to have your company once again. If you're a first timer to this podcast, I have an apartment on the east coast of North Cyprus, but I currently still live and work in the UK, sadly. But there's still time. On the other hand, my co-host Roger Barra has been living the dream for some 12 years in the TRNC. So he joins me now. And Roger, Easter time, we're almost at the end of March. Our weather's been pretty rubbish. It's nice. It's quite nice and bright today, I have to say. I'm expecting that yours has been a bit more settled.
Hi, Sarah. Yeah, hello to all of you. It's amazing that most of our communication with families back in the UK or back in France are just talking about how dire their weather is. And it's really difficult for us because, you know what it's like here. It's just gorgeous. And even Mrs. B's, a lot of her family are in Dorset. They've had snow at the end of March in Dorset of all, it hardly gets any snow at all because it's so far south. You won't believe this, Easter weekend, and we've hit a heat wave.
Oh, wow.
This morning at 10 o'clock, I just finished my run, and it was already 26 degrees, and temperatures expected in the next couple of days to reach 30 and maybe even peak around 34. And we're
Goodness.
barely in April. So there are no complaints here, Sarah.
I'm glad to hear it. And of course, you've got a busy weekend as well, because you're going to be going north, aren't you? You're going to be a northerner. I mean, I know you're in the north of Cyprus already, but even north and north of Cyprus.
We are in fact moving, and we're going from just outside Iskele on the east coast. We are becoming Westerners
A
from a
Western.
quarter past three this afternoon and moving to Kashiaka, which we've absolutely fallen in love with. And we've fallen out of love with the Iskele region because of all the high-rise buildings. And we've talked about this all before, and it's become less cosmopolitan. And there's so many Russians now living there that it's almost impossible to get a job in the tourist industry unless you speak fluent Russian. And that's not what we came here for. We wanted cosmopolitan. We didn't want to be overrun by British people, but we wanted a nice mix of Turkish Cypriots, Iranians, Germans, Russians, the whole McCoy, because that's one of the great things about living abroad. But I've got to change my football allegiances now and go from
No.
Iskele. I've now got to support Kashiyaka, which will be just up the road from our bungalow. And they are notorious supporters, so I should fit in quite well. They've got a big sign outside their football ground saying in Turkish, "Welcome to hell," like Galatasaray have in Istanbul, And so I'm thoroughly looking forward to that.
Well, that will be interesting if Iskele come over and play, because obviously Barry Miller is a huge Iskele supporter. So that would be an interesting dynamic if the two football teams happen to meet. Well, we're going to talk football a little bit later on with our guest, but first of all, a couple of things. There's been some more tragedy on the roads. Is that right? Story today in Cyprus today.
We've had a terrible week, Sarah, of the headlines in Cyprus today. Stop murder on the roads. And people are saying these are not accidents. I'm not saying people have done it deliberately, caused them, but they've done this with such wanton bad driving. Perhaps it's closer to murder than a mere accident. And of
Wow.
course, we've been talking about this for years, ever since our podcast started, 3.5 years ago or 3 years ago. Is it four?
No,
Three,
not
four.
quite, not quite. It just feels like four,
Okay. Nothing changes, does it? Nothing changes at all. And every day on social media, you can see sometimes people with their cameras at the front of their car will show you absolute idiot driving and irresponsible driving. So you've got all that. And on page four of today's paper, there are one, two, three, four stories, and every one is a traffic accident. One dead, three injured as car mounts pavement. Man critical after Alsancak smash. Teen killed by drunk driver. Lorry hits pedestrian. That's just one page. It is desperate. And a lot of expats say they don't really feel safe on the road anymore. And, you know, like tomorrow afternoon, Sunday afternoon is notorious for drink driving over here. You know, a lot of people go out, and, especially now the weather's heating up. They'll have a picnic. They'll have their raki and their whiskey, and then they get in the car and drive home.
Yeah,
and hope for the best.
Well, the penalties are pretty severe. I mean, it's enough to, you know, put us certainly off. You know, if we know we're driving over there, well, anywhere to be honest, here as well, it's sort of ingrained now. But the penalties are quite severe. You can go sort of straight to prison and don't pass go. But that doesn't seem to deter people. Is it because they're just not learning, or they're coming from other countries and they're just getting, you know, they're just getting a license and you know, just not learning from other countries? Or,
well, it's nothing to do really with the state of the roads or the street lighting, which a lot of authorities in the past have said, this is what we've got to do. No, you've got to teach people how to drive properly, whichever nationality they are. It doesn't make any difference. And it's not happening. And it does make, you know, you just have to drive and assume that everybody around you is a complete idiot and is going to do something stupid at any moment. Yeah. It's actually quite tiring if you concentrate like that, you know, for, let's say, a two-hour drive. It's something else. And it's very, very sad, because for all of these accidents, you know, there's a family or two absolutely ripped apart. And it's such a shame.
Oh, what a shame. What a shame. On the less gloomy side, there is a lovely story coming out of the horrible fires that decimated parts of the forest lands in the Carpaths in 2022. So that's a bit more of a pick-me-up.
It is, and sadly, it's a tiny story towards the back of the newspapers, but it's a lovely one. About over 150,000 saplings have been planted in that fire-hit zone, which, when you drive past it, you know, although the countryside is amazing at recovering from these tragedies, it still can look pretty black and barren. But 150,000 have been planted. And I quite like the way they do that over here, because that is going to make one hell of a difference. And 150,000 new trees is no bad thing at all. And it was 2,600 hectares were destroyed back in June of 2022. No fatalities, extraordinary. And we had some amazing pictures, which I know we described in our podcast, you know, the couple of years ago. But a nice story hidden away at the bottom of page 15. What a shame.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? Trouble is, you know, bad news makes news, sadly, sometimes. And it's, you forget about the good stories and whatever. So talking about good stories in a way, let's get on to our special guest for this episode. And I'm not sure I can believe this, Rog, but as an Arsenal fanatic that you are, you've just interviewed an equally fanatical Manchester City fan just hours before both sides meet in what could almost be a Premier League title decider. So how did you get, who are you chatting to, and how did you get on?
Of course, I met him in the pub watching football. His name is Daz Parton, and his family have an amazing historical background in the military, as we'll hear shortly. I've always described Daz as one of the nicest Manchester City supporter I've ever met. He's built like a brick, what's the name? But he's one of the mildest mannered, nicest guys you will ever meet. And I said to him, because he has lived in the South and the North, and because being in the military, he knows his history of this island, I wanted to talk to him before he left the island. And as we'll hear at the end of the interview, he's actually got no choice. He's got to leave the island, and he'll tell you why. And also, he has a lot to say about the United Nations, and considering he worked for them for a number of years, I was quite surprised to hear that. So I want to encourage everyone who's listening to this, please do listen right to the end of the interview, because Daz Parton is one hell of an interesting guy, and he also knows what he's talking about. And I'm sure he's going to provide a lot of thought-provoking material. So, Daz came round, bless him, he's leaving the island in, you know, 30 hours or so. But he spared me some time for this interview and began by telling me a little of his background.
I was born in Manchester in the UK in 1967. So I grew up in a place called Ancoats, which is very close to the town centre and where the new Etihad campus is now. And then when I was a child, we moved over to Higher Openshaw, which is still on the east side of Manchester. So that was, grew up, so three brothers and a sister.
And we'll talk about the city a little bit later on. Am I right in assuming that your family history is deeply rooted in the military?
Yeah, you could say that, Roger. We've my great-grandfather, my grandfather, my dad done his national service, my elder brother. So we've all been a military sort of, always for me as a child, you know, the military has always been a thing that I wanted to do. So, you know, my great-grandfather was one of the casualties on the first day of the Battle of the Somme.
Wow.
So, you know, the age 20, he was one of the old Salford pals. So back then, all the guys just got together and went off for the king to do their bit. So he joined. So all the towns in UK all had their old pals' regiments. So he joined the 15th Battalion of the Lancashire Fusiliers, mainly, and it's all lads that, you know, we'd probably grown up with, so they've all been friends together, all went off to war, and unfortunately he didn't come back. So he was one of the I think it was 19,140 guys that died that day on the first day of the battle, with 56,000 casualty. I think it's the worst, the bloodiest day ever in the British history. So, wow. You know, age 20. And the ironic thing is he left to go to France. His partner then, Martha, my great-great-grandma, she was pregnant. So if she'd not been pregnant, I might not be here today giving you this interview. Yeah. So that's what it's all about. So
it sounds literally like you had no option but to go into the military.
It's probably in my genes or whatever, you know, it's always interested me as a child. And then we've seen that. Didn't really know my grandfather because my grandfather died when I was young. So I know he'd come to live with us in the latter stages. So, but I was a child, I was only like 2 or 3 years old. So when my great-grandfather passed, Martha gave birth to, she named him Martha after his dad, so to keep a name. And then he went off into the Second World War. And then, like I say, my dad done his national service like everyone did then. My elder brother joined. So I was young, so still at, I think I was probably about 11 years old, 10 years old when my brother went off and joined the army. So I've always been fascinated by it. And
so then, how did you start out? What was the first thing you did in the army?
So I joined the, I wanted to follow like my brother. So he was in the Royal Artillery. Uh-huh. So I went off to Woolwich in London to do my basic training back in 87. Passed my basic training. And then I went out and joined my regiment in Germany. Germany was where all the units were at the time because we were just waiting for the Russians to come over the hill. So they stuck us. So we was all classed as BAOR, British Army of the Rhine. So I got posted to a place called Munster, which is sort of like mid Germany, Dortmund, sort of like the industrial area of Germany. And there was 4 regiments on our camp. So I became part of 2nd Field Regiment, which was the Manchester Gunners. So back in them days, you know, when I was joining in the 80s and that, you all had shadow regiment or regiments where they were recruited from.
Oh, right.
And being a Manchester boy, I was always destined to go to the Manchester Gunners. So we went off to the Manchester Gunners and started learning my trades then with the guns and everything else. So we had the big 155 self-propelled guns. At the time, it was an M109 gun, it was called. American-based sort of, but ours was just a little bit more advanced than what the Americans had. And then, like I say, Germany was just fantastic. As a young lad, all you do is you were just, like you say, you're just waiting for. So you had an opportunity to do a lot of sport. So I remember marching in to see my sergeant major on day one, and before I'd even spoken, he said, "You're boxing." So I ended up doing inter-battery boxing. So, but, you know, it was a great introduction to the regiment because everyone gets to know you. And I was fortunate enough to win all my fights to get up to the final. So on the finals is a big event, you know, outside on the regimental square, and the whole regiment's out there in the best dress watching the boxing. So within a short time, people get to know you and recognise who you are. My brother was in a different battery. So the regiment's made up of gun batteries, and we had an air defence battery attached to us. And my brother was part of that. So them first years in Germany were all fantastic, mainly sport. After the boxing, because as a child growing up in Manchester, it was just football. Yeah. So I played football. I played for my school and done bits and bobs. The army introduced me into more sports. Mm. So boxing, I'd never done, which I did. Then I went on to do tug of war. So. Which we get to a really good standard of tug of war. You know, I was fortunate enough to go to compete in the Braemar Games up at where the Queen's up at Balmoral. Yeah. So you meet some real top people. You know, the King now, Prince Charles, when he was Prince Wales, he used to do the Royal Tournament when we used to go to Earl's Court.
Yeah.
And compete in that. So while the gun run and everything else, but there used to be tug of war. So, yeah. And then I got introduced to rugby, which we'd done a little bit at school, but nothing much as... And then because of my size, people always said, oh, you need to play rugby. So I ended up playing rugby. So whatever. I probably spent the first 6 months in tracksuit. All my superiors are always saying, have you got any green kit? And I said, well, you keep putting me on all these sports. It's not my fault.
Yeah, where do you find time to actually be a soldier?
That was just the life then back in Germany. You know, we were constantly on... alert, and we'd get crashed out, or there was a thing called the active edge, so you'd be prepared, ready, your kit would be all packed, and then they would give the order, so you would all deploy as if you was going off to defend a certain area, so it was to stop them advancing up to the Rhine. So we'd all go off to our little areas, spend a couple of nights there, and then we'd come back to camp. So that was it for the first few years. And then in 93, we had options for change with the army. With, you know, they didn't want such a large army, so they started reducing it down. So I ended up getting posted to Woolwich, back to Woolwich to the training depot as a driver. So I was attached there as a driver, assisting in the... It was still a training depot then. And I used to just assist in the guns going out onto... They used to go down to Salisbury Plain. So we'd drive them down to Salisbury, or we'd do different things around London district. I was involved in the ambulance strike during the time there. We all were asked to assist in that.
Of course, I remember that.
Yeah, so, all good times.
Tell me, as a soldier, let's go back to Germany for a second... Was there any time, as you're so highly trained, you wished the Russians had come over and that you actually had to put your training into operation?
I think because you are at such a state of readiness, you know, you want to... You do go off, so you go off to Canada. So you do go away and do train, you know. So you're up to a certain standard, but they'd ship you off to Canada and do the medicine man exercises, which is a massive training area in Suffield in Batters. So, you know, you would practice right up to like war standard. So,
but did you ever wish the Russians had stepped over the mark so that you know, in other words, I suppose I'm asking, did you want to see combat?
Well, combat come anyway because of, you know, in 91 the Gulf War kicked off. So regiments, my regiment was involved in the first Gulf War. Mm. So, you know, combat did come, not with the Russians, but with other forces. So the lads, there was a lot of people that had never been anywhere. So to go to the Gulf War, a lot of the lads have been to Northern Ireland, but that was about it. So to go off to do something, to use the guns properly, yeah, like they were designed to be done. So, yeah, so massive commitment, the first Gulf War. But, you know, it was over and done with before you know it, mm-hmm. with the technology and everything else. Yeah. I just wish we could have finished it off then, and then it probably wouldn't have escalated to what the state it's in now. So
interesting. We could go on and talk about your army career non-stop, but my next question is the fascination of what are you doing here? What is, you know, a highly trained soldier doing in the Turkish Republic of Northern Cyprus, which doesn't really exist as far as most of the world is concerned? What are you doing here?
Well, I, during my career and all, I've done a couple of the Optoska tours. So on the Green Line, on the buffer zone.
Yeah.
So I've been to Cyprus a couple of times, and in 2004, my wife Sharon and our youngest son at the time come over, and I was here for 6 months, but the UN give you 2 weeks R&R, so rest and relaxation, and they used to pay for a hotel for a couple of weeks. So I went down to Paphos with Sharon and our youngest son, and we managed to get one of the British retained. So in the Nicosia Airport, St. Martin's camp, there's quarters there. So the British retained staff that are in Nicosia, they've got some surplus quarters. So you can hire them. So luckily, Sharon was working in a school and Dean was on his 6 weeks holidays. So after the 2 weeks, we decided to take one of the surplus quarters, and they stayed out for the 4 weeks. So during that 4 weeks, you know, I was still back at work, but we used to finish by 1:30. So we'd go off and we discovered the island. We drove off. I was fortunate to be at the rank where I had my own vehicle. So we'd go off and come over to the north side. We'd go down Paphos.
Because the border had only just opened about.
Yeah, Hagia Dimitris opened, I think it was about 2003, something like that. Mm. And the Kofi Annan plan and everything else, that was all that big rife at the time. Yeah. So it was all... So that time then, it was opening up lots of places for people to go and see. I liked the north, because we used to go to a lot of functions in the north from Nicosia. At the time, we lived in the buffer zone. Mm. So we all lived in troop houses along the buffer zone. So now they've all been centralised in Ledra Palace. But at the time, we were all living in troop houses, so it was great. Little sections just along the buffer zone. So when we used to go off to dinner nights and social events, we always seemed to go over to the north. So I got to know the north quite a lot during the time. And then what happened, I finished my tour. I went back to Germany, and we decided to come out and see... see what we could do in Cyprus. So I left Germany in 2008. I had 6 months left in the army to finish my 22 years. And I got attached to the battalion in Decalia, was PWRR, so Princess Wales Royal Regiment. So I only had 6 months left in the army then, Roger. So the idea was to come and just see out my administration, you know, just get... Because they wanted to send me back to UK from Germany to do my resettlement, but the plan was always come to Cyprus anyway. So I was fortunate enough for the infantry battalion in Decalia to take me on because of my qualifications and everything else. So we went off to Decalia in 2008, and the commanding officer, you know, said to me, "Sergeant Major, I know you're here to just see your time out, but... my MTO's deployed out Herrick then," which Herrick was Afghanistan, was really busy, 2008, 2009. So he had two companies deployed. So the battalion was heavily involved with that. So he asked me to go in to do a job. So I said, "Look, Colonel, you've given me the opportunity to get my kit over from Germany to sort myself out here before I leave the army. So, you know, I'll do anything." So, and after the 6 months had finished, the artillery had said, "Right, thank you very much, but that's all you are to them, Roger, you're just a number." So I was still on my RQ's PID back in Germany, so they needed to fill that bid. So they said to me, right, thank you very much, see you later. But the commanding officer in Dhekelia was like, no, you're not going anywhere. So I recatbadged and become a Princess of Wales Royal Regiment warrant officer.
So you stayed in the army?
I stayed in the army. They asked me to stay on. So I got continuance. So I should have left in 2009, and I didn't leave till end of 2012. So I stayed with the battalion. They arms plotted back to Woolwich from Dhekelia. And the commanding officer said to me before he left, he said, I've sorted something out for you. So two Royal Anglian were coming in to take over part of Queen's Division. So I thought something was going to be, you know, with them. But I'd managed to find me a job back with the UN in Nicosia. So I went up to Nicosia and become part of BRITCOM, which is the British contingent in Nicosia. And my job was the continuity warrant officer. So I used to be embedded with the guys that were on the six-month tour on Optosca as their continuity warrant officer. So living in, you know, staying in Ledger Palace in the ops room, and I used to just advise the CO and the guys on, because the op fours, so the Greek side and the Turkish side, will always try it on with a new unit. So having someone there that knows the history and what goes on. So they'll always, it's the same whenever you go. Northern Ireland was the same. When a new unit comes in, they just try to see what they can get away with. So having a warrant officer there who can advise. So
let me ask you a straight question. Is there any necessity, do you feel, these days for the UN to be here in Cyprus?
That is such a topical thing for me, Roger, because, you know, if you think, you know, everyone goes on about the United Nations and what wonderful work they do. But when you look at the history of the UN, you know, there's been occasions, you know, I've done three tours of Bosnia and a tour of Kosovo. That first tour of Bosnia is probably the worst tour, even with Iraq and everything else I've done in my life, that first tour. So the UN signed over to NATO on the 30th of November 1995. I was on the ground in Bosnia on the 2nd of December. So a couple of days, what I saw will stay with me forever. And, you know, for the United Nations to have been there and to, you know, you think of Srebrenica and what happened with the 8,000 men and boys and, you know, and it was the same to the areas where we moved up to a place which was a Muslim area, Sanski Mosque, and you didn't see any men. You didn't see boys. All it was women and children. That was, and it's just, it will always stay with me, that first tour. The thing, you know, Bosnia was always to me, you know, I'd done three tours in the late 90s. And every time I went, I seen an improvement. So I feel we achieved something in Bosnia. I don't think we achieved anything in Iraq. We just made the place worse. And Afghanistan, I honestly, truly believe we did make a difference. But the way, you know, it's going now, you see, you read some reports in the press and everything else. But, you know, for me, I feel that was a success, Kosovo and Bosnia, for NATO and for the British elements that were out there.
What about for dear old Cyprus, though?
For Cyprus, well, when you think about it, so they've been here since, you know, 63, so 64. So they come, you know, all the atrocities that had gone on. So they give them their independence in 60, you know, and then the killing starts in 63, you know, in December. You had all that Christmas period and everything else. So the UN arrive, and for, you know, 10 years, they just carried on watching what was happening. You know, and it was the same. It was like going back to Bosnia. It was exactly the same. You know, they were just allowing to, What the Turkish Cypriots were going through, and not just Turkish Cypriots, Greek Cypriots, because Ayoka were just taking pots at, you know, anyone that they, you know, they wanted to. So, and I think that's where a lot of people, you know, don't understand. You know, it wasn't just the Turks that were killing; they were killing the British, they were killing Greeks, they were killing, you know, anyone who was not for mainland Greece. Then, you know, they were one of their targets.
So. And the UN. I mean, I know a previous guest of ours, the lovely Willie Lint, who was a UN soldier back in the day, the early days, 63, 64, he said effectively his bosses in the UN were telling him that Turkish Cypriots are just a load of terrorists.
Yeah, see what I mean? So, yeah, I feel if the UN, because they've been here such a long time. No, it's 50 years. It's 50 years. Yeah, it is 50 years now, isn't it? Huh? So 60. No, 60 years. So they've been here 60 years. Yeah. And there is no, you know. So for me, the sooner they go, or the sooner, you know, because you go in IKEA, or you walk around Jumbo's in the south, you've got Turkish Cypriots with Greek Cypriots, you've got everyone, you know, everyone. The problem we've got with this island is especially on the south side, because we lived... So for 12 years, we lived in the south. Because of my staying with the military, and when I left the military, I worked on the bases. So I stayed working in the south. So for the 12 years we were in the south, all you get brain... Well, the locals will just tell you how they you're in 74. There is no date before 74, as far as the south's concerned. Everything happened in 1974.
Oh, the intervention.
Yeah,
the intervention. Which, of course, they call the invasion.
Yeah. So they'll only talk from that day onwards. They don't want to really talk about the 50s and the 60s. They just want to talk about 74. Mm. So you get their side of the story. But with my experience of working with the UN, I knew both sides of the story. So, you know, I know who were, you know, the ones who were suffering some more. So I just feel that, you know, the UN, and whenever there seems to be, you know, the Annan plan... If the Annan plan was allowed to, which the Turkish TRNC voted overwhelmingly for, you know, if they'd have gone with it, and I think the Archbishop or someone went on TV the night before in the south and told them all, don't vote for it, we're going to go in the EU, they'll kick the Turks off the island and blah. So I feel if the Annan plan was allowed to go, it would have been resolved a lot sooner. Mm. The property... nightmare that's probably going to be wherever. So I think that Annan plan was probably the best prospect or the best possibility. Yeah. You never know, because, you know, in hindsight.
What about the future? Do you see any possibility of the Cyprus problem being resolved anytime soon?
I can't see it anytime soon, Roger. My true feeling is, you know, this side, which is fair enough, they'll only want the two-state. So that it's the two-state solution for them, or it's nothing. And I know that the south are never going to go. So it's just, you know, you're going round in circles. So I don't know. I don't know what the future is for the island. And I just feel so sorry for the people that, you know, come here and, you know, it's still the only divided place, you know. Well, what's going on across the water at the moment, you know, we never know how that's going to resolve. So if that ends up a two-state, so you may see something. I don't know. I'm just speculating and guessing at what I don't know. But for me, I can't see a solution here.
What's life been like for you and Sharon in North Cyprus?
Well, like, we come over here, so we'd lived... So we've been in Cyprus totally now, 16 years. So we spent 12 years in the south. I'm 4 years now over this side. So we actually love the island. You know, it's such a, but it's changed so much. The change, so when we first moved here in 2008, the south was very much like what the north was, what I remember, you know, tavernas, everyone was all happy. You'd go and sit in a restaurant and people would just chat and they wouldn't be rushing you out like cattle, you know. It's gone too commercial. So the south went commercial very soon, very quick. So it took away all that nice, you know, you know, what you fall in love with, and which we loved about it, the way the peace, you know, the way of life, it's so relaxed and everything else. So the years was in the south is because we worked over there. So I've always wanted to move over to the north. When I got to 55, I decided I was going to slow down a bit. So we did. So I left my job on the base and we moved over here 4 years ago. And I'd done nothing for a year. Just potted around, just enjoyed the life, go down, loving life. Children used to come over from UK. We had great times with the grandchildren and everything. And then you get bored. So, you know, I needed to still do something.
So you went back to work?
So I went back part-time. So just working a few shifts back over on in the south side. And so I had the best of both. So I would go over and work in the south and then spend our social time and live over in the north.
How much of a... First of all, why are you leaving? Because you obviously love Cyprus so much.
Well, there's an opportunity that's come up now overseas, which I can't turn down. And to be honest, Roger, I don't... See, if I turn it down and then in 6 months' time or a year's month's time, more rules change because... Regarding the residency here, it's turning into an absolute, you know, I'm not being funny, but as a renter, because I was working in the south, they would give me the high income, so I would only get 6 months. Even though my wife would get a year, they would only ever give me 6 months, which is fair enough. But every 6 months, so one time I renewed my residency and it had not come through. It taken seven and a half months to come through, so it was already out of date. So when it come through, I'm like, well, what do I do now? It ran out in July. This is now August. So I resubmitted again, renewed it, and every time, so for what have I done? This is probably the seventh time I've renewed it since I've been here, and it's the same old paperwork, the same old you've got to do this. You've got to, you know, it changes so many times and there's different rules. So my thing is, I said to Sharon, look, let's not turn down this opportunity. So we're going to move overseas because in a year's time, we may be forced to leave anyway. So
because the criteria for a renter for residency is getting astronomical now in terms of what you need behind you.
Yeah, well, you think about it now. I think it's 25,000 TL. Per month, so I'm sponsoring my wife, so that's six times that. So that's 1.2 million TL. So I know the TL at the moment is against the pound, but it's a significant amount of money. You've got a lot of expats here, British retirement age, that, you know, who are struggling to try and find this sort of money, especially if they're renting. And the problem with it is, right, a lot of the rents they want in sterling. You know, it's not as if you're paying in TL, you know. And the prices, I cannot believe how much things have gone up in the last 3 months. Just 3 months, you know, we moved into a lovely property, rented. We were renting in the south, but we rented in the north as well. We got a lovely property and we were paying £560, which was a great price for the house, lovely. And then 12 months ago, because prices had started going up, we was getting more investment coming from other nations, coming to the island. So prices started going up. So we went up by £100, 660, which is fair enough. I'm happy. I was happy to pay that. Beautiful. I'm now moving. I'm leaving at the end of the month. And the rent on the property I've been in for the last just short 4 years is £1,800 sterling.
Per month.
Per month, which is nearly triple.
So what you're saying, if you didn't take this job offer, you might have to leave anyway.
Yeah, I would probably have to go back over to the south. Okay. That's because I thought I would never say this, but to live in the south, you would never say in any other time I've been living in the south, it was cheaper to live in the south than the north. But it's getting now to go out and have a meal, to have a few drinks. You know, when you add it up, you can go out just the same in the south. So it's catching up. It's still a place, you know, a nice, but financially, you were so much better off in the north side, but now it's catching up and it's just getting, I just think it's getting silly. And I don't know how it's going to stop or if it's going to stop, but something's got to give somewhere.
I know we can't talk about your new job for all sorts of reasons. So why don't we finish with talking about, well, the shirt you're wearing, a Manchester City shirt. I mean, first of all, their very first Champions League win last season. You went to see in Istanbul. How'd you wangle that?
Yeah, so I've always managed to get tickets from... So when I'm ever back in the UK, I've always managed to get tickets from friends. So I've been growing up as a child, Roger, my three brothers were all United. Really? All my friends were United. So everyone was Manchester United mad. And then my teacher at school, in my primary school, was such an influence on me. He was a City. So I just, I've always been like the black sheep of the family. So as a child growing up, City were all that, and then Dennis Stewart scoring that overhead kick in 76. So, you know, the memories, things like that. So joining the military, coming back, whenever I was at home, I always managed to get to a game. Yeah. Managed to go to, I have been fortunate enough to see them lift the Premier League when I've been back on the time, got tickets. I've seen them win the FA Cup. So I've seen them win everything. So once they got to the Champions League final.
Which of course was in Istanbul, wasn't
it? Yeah. Well, the one prior against Chelsea, because of COVID, I wanted to go to that, but because they moved to Portugal, because it was going to be in Turkey, wasn't it? Yes, so, So what happened was, due to COVID, if you was going direct from UK, you could go to the game in Portugal. But because I was coming from Cyprus, my journey was starting in Cyprus, I couldn't go. No, so I missed out on the Chelsea. Well, luckily.
But it was all worth it in the end last year.
Yeah.
Okay, now what's going on here? You're leaving in 2 days' time. And you will be at 35,000 feet at the time of the game of the season so far, Manchester City at home to Arsenal. How did you let that happen?
Well, I can't do the flight timings, but fortunately, British Airways have Wi-Fi, so I will be on. I will be following the game on that flight. So I'll hopefully see the goals go in.
In the Man City now, I hope.
Well, you never know, Roger. You never. If I'm telling you now, if Arsenal come away from that game, even with a draw, I think because of the running, I think Arsenal, they've turned the corner. I think I don't think they're going to let it happen what happened last season. So you know, if City lose the game, I think it's in Arsenal's. If it's a draw, I still think you know that might let Liverpool in. Yeah. So. But do you know what? It's just fantastic that it's we've got 10 games to go and it could be anyone's.
Yeah.
Well, that was Daz Barton speaking to me less than a day and a half before he moves away with his lovely wife, Sharon. He moves away for good. Extraordinary stuff there, Sarah, particularly the way he says on the Greek side, they think history. The trouble started in 1974, and that's what gets Turkish Cypriots knocking their heads against the brick wall and screaming out loud.
Yeah, absolutely. It was really fascinating to hear that his encounters, because as you say, he's been on the Green Line. He knows the South, he knows the North. So it was really interesting to get his perspective on it all. And such a shame that he's got to leave North Cyprus. I mean, you know, that it's just, he's just literally, but I know he's got another job to go to, but he's literally being pushed out. If he wasn't going to this job, he'd have to go somewhere else anyway.
And how many families, Sarah, are we hearing about with exactly the same problem? Bearing in mind that the amount of money you need for residential purposes is linked to the minimum wage, and we all know what's happening with the minimum wage. It's doubled recently. It's going up at least twice this year. So what Daz was quite clearly saying, and he won't be the only chap in that situation, okay, we might satisfy the criteria this year, but what about next year?
Yeah, that's the thing, isn't it? Yeah, so it's a watching brief and sort of see how it goes. But well, we wish him all the best, him and his family, and you know, it's sorry that he has to go, but hopefully he'll get back for holidays, and no doubt he'll text you whatever the score is.
Well, yes, he'll text me if City win. I'll probably text him if Arsenal win. I think that's the way it usually works. But I've watched Man City Arsenal games with him. And, yeah, he cheers and shouts loudly like I do. But there's never any bad language. There's never any sulking if the result doesn't go your way. So it's, to me, the perfect football fan, full of passion. But once the 90 minutes has gone, that's it. Let's get back to real life, you know.
Excellent. Good. OK, well, I know you're busy as well because you've got boxes to pack and moving things to do. So we wish you and Mrs. B all the best as well over in your new place. So I know you've been over there for quite a little while, backwards and forwards anyway. So I hope it all goes very, very well for you. So on that note, we'll say goodbye for now. Thank you very much indeed again for listening. Do subscribe wherever you listen to this podcast, because then you'll know when we next pop up. You can tell your friends about it as well. If you want to get in touch with us, if you'd like to be on the podcast, or you know know somebody that would be, you know, who's got a story to tell. Everybody's got a story to tell about why they've ended up in the Turkish Republic or North Cyprus. We'd love to hear from you. We're on Facebook and Twitter, or what was Twitter, X, and just look for Talking Round North Cyprus. And we have an email address as well, which is trnc.podcast@gmail.com. I'm Sarah Palmer.
And I'm Roger Barra. Very much hope we'll talk again very, very soon.